Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Think on your feet for our Fast and Curious 5K, a one-of-a-kind race hosted by WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times on Saturday, July 27th at Humboldt Park. More info and early bird registration at WBEZ.org/events.
Hey, y'all, Nerdette is on spring break this week, but we have something we are very excited to share with you. It is an episode from a show called The Culture Study Podcast, and it is hosted by friend of Nerdette, Ann Helen Peterson. It is a show about exploring the nooks and crannies of the culture that surrounds you. Each week, Anne and a super smart co-host answer listeners' questions about the stuff they find interesting and perplexing. Like, why do clothes suck now? Is Paw Patrol copaganda, or is it just not that deep? And what's the deal with everyone we know getting a divorce? The Culture Study Podcast is funny, insightful, and kind of weird, and it will help you become the most interesting person at the party. Here it is.
How would you describe A Court of Thorns and Roses to someone who has never heard of it?
Okay, it's a series of romantasy books, which means that they are big fantasy world books, but they have a lot of romance stuff happening in them. And it's about a young, initially human woman who falls in love with a super sexy old fairy daddy, and he can shapeshift into a lion beast thing. And the first book is sort of Beauty and the Beast inflected, but after that, everything goes off the rails in a good way.
This is the Culture Study Podcast, and I'm Anne Helen Peterson.
And I'm Catherine Van Arendonk, and I'm a critic at Vulture.
Then I am, like, positioning myself right now at the beginning as someone who loves romance but does not consume a ton of it. And I think we can maybe unpack some of those reasons why as we go through. But I have been enthralled by various franchises over the course of the last however many years of my adult life. But we should backtrack just a slight amount and say that today's episode is all about specifically the romance fantasy series A Court of Thorns and Roses, which we're going to call, I call it ACOTAR. How do you pronounce
ACOTAR,
it?
ACOTAR, yes.
ACOTAR by Sarah J. Maas. And part of the reason we're doing this is that every time I post a What Are You Reading thread for subscribers on my newsletter, there's always this really interesting and I think very familiar to both you and I conversation about, why do I love this series? Why do I feel certain ways about this series? Like, just complicated feelings about this series. I think a lot of affection for it, a lot of defensiveness, which makes sense, and a lot of ambivalence. And I think that leads me to how I have been describing it, which I think undersells it, but leads to interesting conversations. Which, when people say, what are you reading? I say, oh, this fairy porn book, right? Which, like, that, it is so, so much more than that. But I kind of like seeing people's reactions when I say that.
Yeah. Yeah. The TikTok preferred term that I see a lot is fairy smut. And, you know, I'm sure we could spend a lot of time breaking down the difference between smut and porn as, like, a concept. But they kind of are pointing at the same idea, right? And there is in both this pre-defensiveness about, like, I know what you're thinking. And what that could mean a bunch of different things, right? Like, I know you think that this is, like, dirty and shameful. I know that you think that this is silly and sort of frivolous and empty. I know that you think that it's mostly about sex scenes and whatever that implies about me. I know that you think that it's for girls only and is mostly about, like, there's just, like, a lot of different stuff. But regardless, calling it that up front is this way of being like, okay, I know it's dumb, but
right. Or to be like, I know maybe you think it's dumb, but I don't think it's dumb.
Yes.
So I should also say, just for listeners to the pod, we are going to do our very best in this first part of the episode to be spoiler-free, first of all, And also to try to root our discussion in a way that makes it accessible to people who have not read the books. Because we want this to be a conversation that is more than just about like the very specifics of these books. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to get down and dirty and talk about the details and have a mini book club discussion. That's going to be just for paid subscribers. So if you're listening to this and already know you want to hear that part, head to culturestudypod.substack.com and join the ranks of paid subscribers. So I kind of want to talk like first where you are coming from.
Yeah.
With these series. Yeah. And root yourself just in terms of literary criticism. Like, we both have pretty interesting backgrounds when it comes to this.
Yeah. So my background is kind of bifurcated. One half of me is I'm a critic at Vulture. I spend a lot of time thinking about like texts, what that word meant pretty broadly. I spend a lot of time thinking about TV in particular, and actually comedy I write about a bit as well. I have a PhD in English Lit from a fancy place, and my dissertation was about serial fiction. So I spend like a lot of time thinking about like very high-minded approaches to like literature and, you know, golden age prestige television or whatever. And also, I read a lot of essentially precursor fairy smut as like a 14-year-old.
Yeah.
It was not fairies. It was dragons. I read obsessively every Anne McCaffrey novel I could get my hands on. Not all of those are dragons. Some of the smuts are more like telepathy smut.
Yeah. There's something super sexy about telepathy, like, because it's at the heart of some Lois Duncan that I really loved as a kid, too.
So good. And so, like, I have always been really a fantasy person. Mm-hmm. But, like, if I actually go back now as an adult and think about the ones that I liked the most, they usually also had romance elements to them. A lot of them were the stuff that Sarah J. Maas points to as the things that were that she was reading at the same point, books like Garth Nix's Sabriel, Robin McKinley books, which I loved deeply, deeply, deeply. She was watching Buffy, like that kind of a thing. And then I have been a romance reader, you know, certainly not with the kind of incredibly lovely attention that like the really intense romance people are, but like on and off, you know, I have gone through periods of my life where like the only thing my brain can really read is romance. And like what grad school, I remember sitting and reading all of Outlander and being like, I should be reading Dickens right now.
Nope.
You know, that's where I am.
Outlander has been a point of conversation with my friend group in terms of how the series has kind of gripped us, some of the more mature and female-focused emphasis on pleasure, that sort of thing. My background, I have a PhD in media studies. I did part of that in English. Like it was my master's was in English. And I really loved Star Trek novels as a young person. And I think that that's where
I was a Star Wars person personally.
Yeah, that was my brother. Yes. That was my brother. Mm-hmm. And like if I think about it, my favorite of all of the Star Trek novels was Imzadi, which is about that mated connection, essentially, to use an ACOTAR term, between Riker and Deanna Troi, who's the counselor. And so it's all about like that romance that gripped me. And then I have periodically, and I think importantly, also during grad school, come to different romance texts as like a real way of rediscovering my love for reading, rediscovering that love of reading the way that I did when I was a teen. And I did a lot of exploration of like what was going on with my fascination with Twilight. I wrote what eventually became like an academic article in Feminist Media Studies about feminist negotiation of that text specifically. So I've thought about this a lot, but like you, I am not like the deep, deep reader of romances and fantasy that I think if I had more time, I absolutely would be. And I think I actually am in a moment where I'm thinking about it more. For me, like during the pandemic, when I struggled to read, I turned to a lot of thrillers, which served like a different purpose in some ways.
Yeah.
But I'm having so much fun right now. I'm nearly done with book five. And it's so hot. So I am in a really great place right now that is, I think, going to be a jumping off point for more things. So that situates us. That's our positionality, as we would say.
Okay.
As former academics. Okay. So let's go to our first question to help us out a little bit more here. So this is about the general landscape of book fandom right now. This is from Elise.
Why does everyone seem to collectively lose their minds over book series and authors these days in a way I can't remember from the past? Harry Potter notwithstanding. Whether it's Allie Hazelwood, Colleen Hoover, or a bunch of people telling me the writing isn't very good, but you just need to read them. Regarding ACOTAR, why are we so cultish about books now? Life is so short. I really don't think fairies fucking would interest me. Why am I crazy for not wanting to read it?
Yeah.
So what do you think? Is this all just TikTok? What's going on here?
Well, there's definitely a TikTok element. And I do think that TikTok is really good at creating this sense of community where it's like you need to read the thing everyone's talking about in order to participate in what that community, like any other community building thing. You have, you have to have some kind of shared texts so that you all are speaking the same language and using the same reference points. And because TikTok is so good at just creating that, like we're all in this place together, we're all responding to each other. And so you do feel this omnipresent sense of like, this is the things everyone is reading. But I do think actually that although social media makes us more aware of and gives us more of a heavy sense of that feeling that authors, that like people are cultish about authors, that this is a tale as old as time, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I hate to get all 19th century on this shit.
Please do.
Like, people were absolutely losing their minds about Charles Dickens. And if you were not up to date on the old curiosity shop, then you were streets behind. And it was like, he was the celebrity of the day. Yes. You know, like, people have been like this about books since books existed. And I think, although, again, in the same way that Instagram makes us feel like everyone else's lives are more aesthetically pleasing than our own, book talk makes it feel like everyone's reading all these books and we have to read them together. It's just the perception that is harder to deal with and not the actual cultishness of it.
Yeah, yeah. I always tell people when they argue that like we are more into celebrity now, it's just that the ways that we are into celebrity are more visible.
Yeah.
It's not any different than the same sort of like fandoms that were around 20th century, like classic Hollywood stars, that sort of thing. And then the other thing I would note, though, is I think that books are coming out faster. And some of that just has to do with, like, we have computers. So it takes less time to type, right, than, like, the speed of production that someone like Dickens was going through in order to get
Although
stuff
that
out,
man
right?
could produce. But the other thing about that is, like, marketing, right? Our marketing cycles are much, much faster.
Yeah.
So it's not just that you can write books faster, but that the industry, because also writers get paid very little, and like you can't make a living unless you're actually writing many books in a fairly short period of time. So I do think there's like a lot of different forces here that are kind of all colliding.
Yeah. And I do think too, like all social media does a very good job at making us feel bad if something doesn't seem interesting to us. And like, I would say that I also avoided this series. Like Melody, our producer, told me about it a long time ago, and I saw various posts that were like, oh, I saw someone reading it in the coffee shop, like what I would give to be reading it for the first time. And because I had never like read fairy stuff before, that was something just about the idea of fairies that like was weird to me, as this person says, fairies fucking. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to not think that something might be your thing. I also think it's worthwhile to try something out. And that's, I came into the series thinking, I don't know what I'm going to think, right? I'm very open to what I'm going to think about this. And if I hate it after the first book, then that's enough. But I did not. So you wrote this great piece for Vulture about Sarah J. Maas in particular. So can you say a little bit about your theory about why people are specifically so into her books? Because it's not just this series. She has two other series. And why there is this, like, this perceived pressure maybe for someone like Elise to read them, even if she doesn't want to.
Yeah. I mean, I think as with everything, there's several things going on here. One of them is there have been waves of romantasy authors that, whether or not they have been marketed as such, which they really have not been until this point.
Yeah.
But like there are precursors and everyone just kind of quietly reads them and everyone goes like, that's my smut, and nobody pays attention to it. But
yep.
But she was really just at a early but well-positioned point in this current wave of interest in them. And because she was writing so early and so much, she's very prolific.
Yeah.
That like if you were kind of going to be into these books, like she was one of the people who she would just be who you turn to.
Yeah.
But I do think there are other things specific to her writing that actually makes them why they have soared to the level of popularity that they do. One of them is she writes from particularly ACOTAR, but the other series a little bit as well, this reconstructed fairy tale kind of space, which is very much from Robin McKinley, who she cites, where you're taking what feel very, very, very familiar fairy tale kinds of tropes, but the relationship shapes that she's dealing with, the kinds of female characters in particular, what they want, what they care about, are more like contemporary
yes.
women.
Yes.
So you're with this fairy tale thing, you're in, you get the magic of that world, but then also you get the person saying like, wow, it's really fucked up that you won't let me leave this castle, right?
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
that the immediate kind of accessibility of that to contemporary readers, I think, is important. One of the other things that I think is really going on here is we are a generation of readers and sort of culture consumers who have become very, very familiar with the idea of trauma plots and the sense that the things that happened to us shape us, and until we can fully integrate themselves into our understanding, our stories of ourselves, we really can't move forward.
Yeah.
And Sarah J. Maas, just some of the most canny, I don't know... I think she is a very intuitive writer, so I'm not saying this like she sits down and then carefully says, like, this was how I will own culture. But she is able to use that trauma plot to stitch together this big high fantasy structure, which is very challenging on its own, and a romance structure, which is also people think is easy and is really hard to do well. And she is able to use these, particularly the heroine's sense of trauma plot, to say that, like, the keys to this fantasy world are not going to be unlocked until you are able to deal with this trauma that you have, which is also then going to enable you to connect in a romantic relationship. Like, they are structurally
yes.
tied together. And
yes.
so there, it is just so effectively built into the way those books work that your brain just goes like, ding, 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 ding. Like, it is, they're very well... craft.
You use this term, I'm trying to remember the exact sentence, but you said that basically like the romantic processing and also the trauma processing culminate similarly, and it turns into what you call a simultaneous orgasm of structural devices. And I mean, that's great for many reasons. How did you write that the first draft, or did your editor help you come up with that?
Oh, no. I wrote it very early, and then I texted it to like three people, and I was like, this is the only line I care about actually making it into the final version of this piece.
But I think you're totally right, right? Like, it's very much in line with the you have to deal with your shit, which is similar to like you have to love yourself, right? You have to mm-hmm, figure out how mm-hmm. to love yourself and see yourself clearly before you can deal with this other stuff. And I think that a complaint that I have heard about the books and about her writing, and again, I haven't read the other two series, but is that her pacing is off, or that mm-hmm. it's weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe when people say that, that's what they're talking about, is that these characters actually, it's not just, oh, I process in act one. It's like, I process in act one, I process in act two, I process like almost all the way through act three. And then in act like four and five, we get a little bit of that culmination. And it's orgasmic. Like, it is hot in terms of like the sex of it, but it's also, I think, very gripping and propulsive in terms of the other plots that are happening in terms of the larger fairy world.
Yes, yeah. And it is a part of all of her series, but it is distinct in ACOTAR because those books are – so the first three ACOTAR books have first-person narrators. And this is, I think, a huge deal. She started writing Throne of Glass when she was 16, which is her first series, and she was really publishing it on an outspurt of a fan fiction website.
Right.
And she was really coming from much more of a big high fantasy structure at that place where she was like multiple character groups spread across a big map. There is that single protagonist and there is absolutely that trauma thing, but I think there is something about the first person narrators of the first three books of ACOTAR that are better fit to the kinds of processing trauma plot structure that she has in those books. They feel more rooted in her experience. Mm-hmm. And then by the time you get to books, well, I'm going to be honest, I don't think 4 is actually a real book. That's my biggest Sarah J. Maas.
I think it's a piece of fan fiction. Maas,
yes,
as a book.
It's a Christmas AU published as a. But book 5, which there is a lot of feelings about book 5, which maybe we can talk about in the second half of this.
Yes.
But like that one's, now you have a third person narrator, but you are already so rooted in this world from this like very bodily first person experience.
Yes.
And so that I think is also a big part of why I think ACOTAR actually works better structurally than her other two series, which have these third person narrators.
That's such a good point. Okay, let's talk a little bit about this new word that people are using for this genre, romantasy. This question comes from Jen.
What is the deal with fantasy romance as a genre? I'm thinking of A Court of Thorns and Roses and Fourth Wing. Where did it come from? Are these Harry Potter fans grown up and wanting erotica?
So I think it's interesting that she comes out of the Harry Potter fan fiction world, right? Where there is a lot of erotic fiction happening.
Yes.
But then I also, and you point this out very deftly in your piece, like this is not the first time that romance and sci-fi or fantasy elements have intermingled. There's a great line in the piece where you're like, there's a difference between sci-fi and fantasy, but we could go there, but it involves talking about spaceships. So we don't need to.
This is going to be a whole different piece of tradition. And I'm willing. I was like, this is the one part I would love to fight with people about. Nobody came for me on how we define these terms.
You did a great job of like talking that through. So what do you think about the current popularity of this particular genre?
Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned before, I do really believe that there have been waves of some expression of this desire in like for decades. And women have been figuring out how to get whatever the closest version of Very Smut is. Since we had mass market paperback like publishing, right?
Yeah.
It is really striking how mainstream it is right now, how fully target end cap we are with these books that like if you were to actually flip through them, you would be like, oh, well, so okay, there's a lot going on in here. And I think it's a lot of different things. I think there is something about the fact that people can read books on their Kindles that has allowed people to feel comfortable reading the kinds of books that they might not otherwise be seen reading, I think, which was a sort of part of the Harry Potter thing.
Oh, and 50 Shades too, right?
And 50 Shades, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. And but also just generally that sense of like, it's okay to read YA fiction if you're older and like YA books with more adult looking covers on them. So people weren't like ashamed of reading them. I think there's that. I think there is a kind of the book talk element that we've been talking about, the pandemic element that I know a lot of us are kind of coming. Suddenly we felt like I can't read anything, but I'm stuck at home. And the only thing that can absorb me is something that fully takes me away. And so there's something about those that as well. I have this other probably wrong theory, but I am kind of fascinated by it, which is that nerd culture and the sort of mainstreaming of Marvel as the only shared text in pop culture happened about a decade ago, and it made the male version of like the thing you wanted to read when you were 14 into the most mainstream possible text. And so it is not shocking to me that it has taken a decade, but that now the version of this that appeals to women is suddenly marketed and everywhere.
Yeah. And there's some old school, you know, like, why do we seek out romance and fantasy? Because our world is broken.
Mm-hmm,
and where do you want to play out some of your ideals or experiments and what a different world could look like. Like, this gives us a tapestry to play in that space, right? Like, yeah. I can be like, oh, everything about our world feels like just really, really intractable in this moment in particular, I think, like, mm-hmm. politically, right? Both domestically and internationally. And so where can you imagine a different world? A world that has problems, but that, like, there is some sort of catharsis. Mm-hmm. There is yeah. possibility for change. There are good men. That's, I think, a big part of this. Big and then also there are men who, and this is like the fantasy of one of our protagonists, there are very powerful men who also think a lot about structural changes that empower women.
Yeah. These books are so much more about overthrowing authoritarian regimes than tends to get coverage, but they really are.
Yeah. Authoritarian, masculine, like patriarchal mm-hmm. regimes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and some of this, I think, can sometimes feel slightly obvious, right? Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Our female protagonist is the first high lady. But then there's also the fact that, like, some of our protagonists have been through sexual trauma. Like, they are dealing with vulnerabilities that are often not allowed to other male protagonists. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I think that's part of it for sure. And then once you get one of these books, right? And if you read through the entire series, then you want more. So people say, oh, if you liked ACOTAR, like, try a Fourth Wing.
Yes,
which
absolutely.
Might be where I go next.
I mean, yeah. we are at the place. I say like target end cap, which is true, but the reality is we're past that. Like, we are in a place where yeah. it's her, but then it is also seven other authors who are there only because of the groove, the marketing groove that these books carved first.
Yes, absolutely. How much do you think is that, like, people want to take joy in reading? Like, that, I sometimes think that that's just, like, under-discussed. Like,
it's a huge part of it. It's a huge, huge, yeah. huge part of it. They are completely absorbing in and at the end of my piece, it's like, these books work when they are able to make you feel like you are a teenager again as you were yeah. reading them.
Yeah.
And the pleasure of them is absolutely the only reason that, like, everyone around us... TV works this way too. We would not yeah. all be watching, millions and millions and millions of people would not be watching Young Sheldon if there wasn't something about Young Sheldon that was like, but it feels good in my brain. You
right,
know?
Right. It's not like these shows like have like, I don't know, like inject us with drugs that make us
no.
like them.
Right? No.
Right? You're just like, oh, it's like sexy. And also it like makes me want to read and makes me want to stay up and like, that is exciting, right? I love that feeling. Like, I'm not even looking at my phone, right? That is great to have that sort of absorptive experience. And it's very seldom that we have it in this
Absolutely.
Moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Our next question comes from Jennifer, and it's about the framing of ACOTAR, broadly speaking.
Is ACOTAR feminist? I am a voracious reader, but new to the fairy smut genre. I just devoured the series in a week. It was recommended by my college students from around the world, and while reading it everywhere, I found that everyone else was also reading it, including all the dental techs at my son's orthodontist appointment. I've never read romance that puts female pleasure in the foreground so unabashedly and focuses on egalitarian relationships. I keep telling my husband that I want the next book, the one where they're married and have kids and life gets boring and complicated, but still incredibly sexy. So are the books feminist, or are they just incredibly for me, a white, cis, hetero, middle-class woman?
I will say I was at the hairdresser mm-hmm. earlier this week, mm-hmm. and I was reading it on my Kindle, when usually I just scroll my phone and I'm like, no, I'm bringing my Kindle. And my hairdresser asked what I'm reading. She's like, oh, I'm halfway through book two. So I had one of those experiences. And she said, too, like, I'm not usually much of a reader, but I, you know, me and another hairdresser are super into these. Mm-hmm. I think it brings us back to this moment that both you and I remember from, like, I don't know, 2008, 2009, when, like, the most popular thing that you could ask a female celebrity was, are you a feminist? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, does it, on another level, like, does it pass the Bechdel test, like, which is a test to see if, like, two women talk to one another about something that isn't a man? Mm-hmm. Is that the wrong question? Is that an interesting question? What are your thoughts here?
I mean, I am a believer in feminism, so I think it's a useful question to ask in the same way it's a useful question to ask. Like, the kinds of messages that we get from books are always worth probing, right?
Yeah.
And I think there are elements, actually, of it that are starkly unfeminist, particularly in book five, which I am ready to fight about as soon as we possibly can. But I also think that in the same way that we turn to fiction, especially to create these playgrounds, as you were talking about, these kind of escapist places, where what's happening is not necessarily that we are reading some kind of tract about how we should be living our lives, but instead we're playing out various fantasies of who we are, what we like, what we don't like. I mean, the internet is chock-a-block with people calling these books problematic, and they are. Like, there are so many places you can point to if what you're interested in is thinking about problematic elements of these texts. People point to race things, people point to feminist things, people point to gender trope things. There's just endless. Yep. Also, people find it like age gap things. She's 20, he's 300. What are we doing? Right? And like, yeah, that's very problematic and also very sexy. And also, a lot of the things that people find sexy and interesting to think about are like not great from a feminist perspective. And like, maybe that's worth thinking about for ourselves. And also, the things that we know are taboo are also things we're interested in. Like, it is so much more complicated than a sort of check mark yes or no situation for these, but also any fiction.
Yeah, to me, it seems like something that is going to be fascinating to look back on by scholars at some point in the future as a means of studying a particular understanding of what feminism looks like in this moment, right?
For sure, yeah.
Because there's a lot, I mean, it's not a pure reflection by any means, but it's a refraction, both in terms of like the way that the sex unrolls, the way that desire unrolls, the way that like power is accumulated and distributed. All of those things are really interesting. And so for me, I think like that's why I said, is this the right question? Like, I think Sarah J. Maas is a feminist. Like that is not like a question for me. The way that she is writing these books, it's woven through all of the fabric. Is this something that, like, to me, it underlines that feminism is constantly under negotiation? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's just for middle-class white ladies. What do you think?
I mean, the fact of feminism being under negotiation is, I think, true for everyone and for men as well and for everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether these books are just for middle-class white ladies is, I think, a different question. I don't think they're for just middle-class white ladies, but I do think they are produced almost entirely by middle-class white ladies, which is not you can't be dismissed. Now, that's not complete. Like, there are absolutely Black women who write romanticy. There are all kinds of people who write romanticy and read romanticy. But absolutely, like, the levers of capitalism have only raised up the white ladies. So there is a bit of an echo chamber that probably is happening between author and reader there. But as far as whether the thing that the actual text is only for middle-class white ladies, I mean, first of all, I know so many gay people who read these books. So, like, this is not just straight cis people. Yeah.
Right. Totally. Yeah. I think sometimes if you are reading it and maybe your friend group is reading it, it's easy to think that you are the only people reading it. But, like, I think that the appeal goes much, much broader.
Yeah.
All right. So, next question. And this is where the comments get heated in the newsletter. Let's hear from Molly.
Why is there so much judgment about reading romanticy like ACOTAR or Fourth Wing? Shouldn't the definition of a good book be based on what brings a reader joy and captivates their attention and imagination?
Hoofda. I mean, this is a long, old conversation, right? Like, and we should say, just by definition, Fourth Wing is another popular romanticy series by an author named Rebecca Yarros. So I think so much of this has to do with, like, feminization of the genre, like, association with mass market paperbacks, like, all of those things, and some discomfort, as you mentioned, that now these books are being more openly consumed.
Yeah.
And part of the discourse. And It's also, I think, it's not cool to shame people about reading them anymore. And so some people who still have those internalized shame mechanisms are grappling with those feelings. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, all of that is happening here. It also reminds me of like a TV academic conference that I was at. This was, I think, in 2010, where it was truly like, why are we all talking about Mad Men when we should be talking about the thing everyone's watching, which is Big Bang Theory? But nobody wants to talk about Big Bang Theory, do they? And just the way that we as a species are obsessed with creating these hierarchies of taste and class in the media and the culture that we produce. And the only way that we are able to have any kind of sense of who we are is by saying we're not them. Yep. And there's like just all of that is happening here. And the shame comes out of all of the things that you are talking about, the sexiness of them, the sense that only women read them. The genre fiction forever has always had this sort of lesser than status than fiction that is realist, that sort of purports to represent the world as we live in it, which is supposed to have a better and more valuable way of reflecting who we are as people. And it is also seen as harder to do, which is bullshit. And, and so, yeah, like this is unfortunately just the newest iteration of the fact that TV was shameful and novels were shameful and fiction as a concept was shameful and plays were shameful. Like just roll it all the way back.
Movies, pulp magazines, mm-hmm. like gossip, celebrity gossip in general. Like we're just, it's fascinating to me that I think in some ways we have moved towards a cultural understanding that like it's okay to consume these things, but we still say like, oh, this is my trashy thing that I consume. Like we mm-hmm. still, there is still that desire to label it or to like push it away or to put your ACOTAR in a stack with a literary book to show like, oh, I also am capable. Of course you're capable of reading those other novels. You can read, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, or just the sense of pleasure itself, which I think we as Americans have such a deeply ingrained puritanical issue with, right?
Yeah.
And like part of the problem is that the books, they just feel so nice. And we're just like, well, that can't be good. That can't be right.
You're like, oh, that sex scene was really fantastic. Like, probably bad, right?
Probably gotta be
all
bad.
All sex scenes. Like, this is what Game of Thrones posits. Game of Thrones and like other, I don't know, so many other quote unquote prestige television, prestige novels, all this sort of thing. It's like, oh, it should always, like, the sex should always be bad. It should always mm-hmm. be trauma. And a lot of sex is bad and traumatic, but a lot of sex is good and hot. And like that doesn't mean that it's shameful to read about a description of it in that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love your point, too, that like this is a real skill, right? Building like a slow build the way that Mass does it, I think, is an incredible accomplishment and undervalued.
The one of the things that drives me the most absolutely bonkers are comments like, I really think I could write one of those if I tried. And it's like, okay, please try.
And, you know, like, as I've been reading, I've been texting back and forth with Melody about some of like the language tropes that come up again and again, like the watery bowels, like whenever mm-hmm. something's scary, her bowels turn watery, which sounds disgusting. And, you know, I love that the beginning of your piece, you take a sex scene, you like put the sex scene at the beginning and you're like, you know what? Like every sex scene, basically in any capacity, but especially in one like this, like it sounds ridiculous.
Yes.
Like, it seems so weird. Like, there's talk about wings and, like, there's a weird innuendo and all sorts of things.
And, like, they're growling at each other. And these books tend to get reduced to this sort of out-of-context sense of, like, it's fairy smut. And you're like, yeah, but any romance novel, even the hottest, best-written romance novels, you take that sex scene out and you're going to be like, that's a stupid word for penis, you know?
Or even like, I think of something like Normal People, which is a very quote unquote literary book by Sally mm-hmm. Rooney that also I think has hot sex in it. and also a lot of trauma. Mm-hmm. But if you take out one of those sex scenes and just put that on there, it's going to sound weird too, because sex is weird.
Yeah.
Like, describing it, you have to have it contextualized within the, like, the romance itself, I think.
Yes,
in order for
absolutely.
It to, like, function. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
If you've read ACOTAR, you know that there is so much more to talk about. If you want to listen in on the mini book club discussion we've had about the characters' personalities, about Sarah J. Maas's writing style, about female pleasure on the page, about what to read next, that's the best part, head over to culturestudypod.substack.com and become a paid subscriber. I cannot tell you how this, like, lived up to all of my expectations.
I'm so glad.
It was fantastic.
Yay.
I really, you know, I recommend people go and read the piece and also just read all of Catherine's writing. She's one of my favorite.
Oh,
you are one
so
of my
nice.
Favorite culture writers. So it was just a real pleasure to have you today. If people want to find more of you on the internet, where can they find you?
I am on Blue Sky, I guess. That's kind of where I've been hanging out recently.
Yeah.
I also have an Instagram, a work Instagram that I don't update all that much. And you can find me at vulture.com. I had a piece about why Bluey makes grown-ups weep recently that you may enjoy.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. What a fun time.
Okay, that was a sample of what you will find each week on the Culture Study Podcast. I hope you loved it. We will be back next week with a regular episode on Friday. And on Tuesday, we are speaking with Marie-Helene Bertino because she is the author of our April book club selection. That is the beautiful book, Beautyland, which I hope you pick up. Talk to you later.
Nerdette is supported by the Sympathizer Podcast from HBO. Join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic HBO original limited series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer Podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.